All right. Good morning, everyone. I am actually very excited that there are a few souls brave enough to attend a session entitled The Physics of Faith, where we'll look at faith at perhaps in a little different manner than you may have traditionally, but I want to do so in hopes of adding a bit of clarity to our understanding of biblical faith, especially in light of so many historical misunderstandings. So as we begin, let's spend a few minutes on the great debate, or perhaps what might be better be called the great faith debate, is what is faith? How do we understand faith? Is it something God does? Is it something we do? Is it belief? Is it action? Is it both? Is it neither? These topics have been hotly debated throughout history, and arguably both the Bible and history demonstrate that mankind has always struggled to understand the nature of God and consequently the nature of a proper, healthy relationship with God, one undergirded by faith. For without faith, it is impossible to please God. And so to do so, I want to take just a brief history of time with respect to misunderstanding faith. So let's go back to the very beginning. Let's go back to Cain and Abel, Genesis chapter 4. Both Cain and Abel believed in God and both acted in response to their belief in God, yet only one, Abel, was said to have exercised faith through which he was made righteous, Hebrews 11, 4. But if you think about it, couldn't Cain have argued that he believed in God? Couldn't he have argued that he took action, that he acted in response to that belief in God? Yet Hebrews 11 says, by faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than did Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous. Ergo, Abel operated by faith and Cain did not. So obviously something was amiss in Cain's operational understanding of faith. So then, as we move on through the Old Testament, we get to Genesis chapter 15 and Abraham, where we might surmise we could learn something from the belief side of the equation. In Genesis 15, we read, Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. So his belief, intellectual acknowledgement, mental affirmation, all that is necessary? Isn't that what God said? We'll have more on to say on that in a moment, but as we continue the journey through history, through the Bible, we get to the New Testament where we meet our old friends, the Pharisees. You know, a continual thorn in the side of Jesus. You know, see the seven woes of Matthew chapter 23, but of whom Jesus said. Now, these guys, they championed religious activity. They championed activity, ritual, and action. But Jesus said of them, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. So obviously a great chasm separated the Pharisees' understanding of justification before God and God's view of justification before God. So again, we see the dramatic disconnect with respect to justification by faith. Now, as we move through the Gospels and get to the early church, it gets a little more interesting, actually a lot more interesting for our purposes this morning. And here we see multiple inspired writers seek to resolve this matter with clear, direct, precise teaching. Paul corrects misunderstandings concerning faith in his audience by writing, Paul corrects misunderstandings about faith in his audience by writing, you see, a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law. But likewise, James corrects misunderstandings in his audience by affirming that, you see, a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Which settled this great faith debate once and for all, right? Well, not exactly. Rather, fierce debate over this apparent contradiction between these two passages served really as the flashpoint in this great faith debate, boiling over in the 16th century when Martin Luther famously tacked his 95 Theses to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, October 31, 1517, sparking the Protestant Reformation, which would ultimately divide Europe into Catholic and Protestant factions, and sets the stage for 100 years, a century of religious wars. Now, just for a little context on that, the Reformation Wars, you might know, culminated in the 30 Years' War and was described this way in history books. The 30 Years' War was the result, was one of the longest and most destructive conflicts in European history, lasting from 1618 to 1648, fought primarily in Central Europe. An estimated 4.5 to 8 million soldiers and civilians died as a result of battle, famine, and disease, while some areas of Germany experienced population declines of over 50%. For Germany, that was twice the mortality rate of World War I. So in summary, this was really no small debate at all. The abuses that compelled Luther to publicly challenge the papacy in this great faith debate would really change the arc of history forever. And thinking about Luther, it really shouldn't be surprising to us that Luther, this guy who after railing against the flagrant abuses of this works-based religious theology, was summoned to trial, was declared to be a heretic, an enemy of the state, excommunicated, lived in fear of his life, and saw his works publicly burned by the Pope. It shouldn't be surprising to us that he might just overreact just a little bit in that scenario. So Luther, in his quest to prove that no prescription, no formula, no procedure declared by a priest or pope could save mankind, could free him from his sins, he led him to disparage the Epistle of James that highlights the rightful place of human activity in the gospel plan. And you can see this in a number of areas. Let me just quote a little bit from Luther's preface to the Epistle of James, where he says, "To state my own opinion about it, though without injury to anyone, I consider that it is not the writing of any apostle. My reasons are as follows. First, it is flatly in contradiction to St. Paul and to all of the rest of the scriptures as it ascribes righteousness to works. It says that Abraham was justified by his works and that he offered his son Isaac, though St. Paul, on the contrary, teaches in Romans 4 that Abraham was justified without works by faith alone before he offered his son, and proves it by Moses in Genesis 15. This fault, therefore, leads to the conclusion that this is no work of an apostle. It is this disorderly collection of writings." So again, we see history repeating itself in this great faith debate, and it continues in dramatic fashion with the inability to properly conceptualize the interplay of belief and works in this biblical notion of justification by faith. Now, some of the, you know, if you look today, some of the modern forms that we might see this in sort of the, you might call it the Protestant refutation of the papacy and works-based Catholicism, you might see it something like this in terms of the so-called five solas. We're saved by Scripture alone, grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone, and to God alone be the glory. Or kind of summarized, you might hear, man is saved through Christ alone, by grace alone, through faith alone. Translation, what does that mean? Practical meaning, a person is saved at the moment he believes in Christ, requiring absolutely no action on his part. Moreover, any such action would be an attempt to earn or to merit salvation. It follows then that water baptism cannot in any way be a part, be a prerequisite to the gospel plan of salvation. So, in summary then, what's the point? The nature of faith has been misunderstood from the dawn of history. The great faith debate has raged from the beginning of time, has contributed to great conflict, has been the source of great confusion, and has led a great many astray. The nature of biblical faith is difficult to understand and can be even more difficult to explain. So, my goal today then is to present another way to conceptualize biblical faith through examining the nature of God and first principles of physics. Now, I want to emphasize up front that I in no way suggest this is the only way or even the best way, but simply a way to conceptualize biblical faith and therefore supplement our understanding of our response to Almighty God. Okay, so now with that as the intro, here's where it begins to get fun. We are going to talk about the nature of things. We talk about the nature of things. We're going to bounce around from topic to topic to topic and kind of zero in on faith. Okay, so first of all, nature of things. Let's talk about the nature of faith. Is it singular or is it multifaceted? Is it digital or is it analog? Is it binary or is it graduated? These are all good questions, but I want to start with something even different. I want to start with this question. What are the requirements for the existence and the propagation of faith? Think about that. Now, as you're thinking about that, we're going to take that and we're going to set it aside. And we're going to go on to the nature of God. Okay? So then, think about the nature of God. What is the nature of God? If I were to ask you, describe God, how would you do it? What would you say? The Bible has so many things to say on that subject. Probably in this room of scholars here, in the scholarly section, your mind is probably going to go to the so-called omnis of God, right? So we could talk about the omniscience of God, the omnipotence of God, and the omnipresence of God, but we won't due to the sake of time, and much has been written on that subject. So next, I know your mind is going to the morphology of God. What is the shape of God? What is the form of God? What is the nature of God? But we're not going to talk about that either right now because, again, lots been written on that and we don't have a lot of time. Instead, I want to pull a single thread relating to the nature of God as it applies to our discussion on faith. And that is the self-existence of God. Okay? So contemplating the nature of a self-existent, eternal God that requires nothing outside of himself for existence, or operation, or propagation of his influence throughout the created order is not a trivial task. It really isn't. For how can we, who exist within the created order, fully perceive that which exists outside of and independent of the created order? But consider this. Do you think that the created order just might be designed in such a manner so as to teach us about the unseen spiritual world? Consider Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day it utters speech, and night unto night it reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Translation, every day the created order speaks to us and reveals knowledge to us about the nature of God. Psalm 111 again says, the works of the Lord are great, studied by all who have pleasure in them. His work is honorable and glorious, and his righteousness endures forever. He has made his wonderful works to be remembered. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion. Okay, so now, with that said, let us look at something inside of creation that helps us to understand that which exists outside of creation, God, if only in a small or limited way. Okay, so now the nature of God and light. One of the fascinating things to me is how God chooses to describe himself. He chooses to describe himself. So 1 John chapter 1, verse 5 says, this is the message which we have heard from him and declare to you, that God is light, and in him is no darkness. Now, I find it extremely fascinating, even quite profound, that a quick journey through the scriptures reveals a myriad of instances of God manifesting himself to his people as what? Some form of light. I mean, who can forget the burning bush? Where God reveals himself to Moses in a flame of fire, or what about the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire that separate God's people from their enemies and lead them to their promised land? What about the temple dedication and even the tabernacle dedication, where the glory of God descends upon those structures in such fantastic, glorious, powerful way that everyone is scattered, even the priests, from the temple and the tabernacle? Or what about one of the seven great I Ams of Jesus? I am what? The light of the world, right? And then number 6, 24 and 25, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you. Did you know that's one of the most quoted passages throughout the Bible? It's like half a dozen times. But anyway, the list goes on and on and on. But I want to look at one last, and I think very significant example of light, and that is creation. What did God create on day one? Is there any significance to the order of creation? Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light. It was good. And God divided the light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So evening and morning were the first day. Now, does God ever do anything randomly? Without thought or reason, or perhaps is there purpose? Is there planning? Is there wisdom? Is there teaching? Is there instruction in the first of the Creator's acts? Now, I missed this for a long time. Perhaps you did not. But I want you to think about this. Did you ever note the distinction between the light on day one and the light on day four? What did God do on day four? He created the sun, and there was light. He created the moon, and there was reflected light, right? He created the stars, the galaxies, and all of the celestial bodies, and there was light. But that light was a byproduct of creation, not that which was created. But not on day one. God created pure, unadulterated, everlasting energy known as light. It was not the byproduct of creation, but it was the essence of creation on day one. And the scripture says, God is light. Coincidence? Maybe not. Okay, now we're going to go down the rabbit hole just a little bit, but hopefully not stay there too long. We're ready now to begin to talk about the nature of fields. Okay, so we're going to go from the concrete to the more abstract. So, and again, be thinking about what is faith, how does it operate, how does it propagate, how does it play out? So I thought about, you know, we don't have enough time. I would bring a prop, I would bring a football, I would call, you know, two volunteers, say, James and John, come up here. I'm going to give you a football, stand toe-to-toe, and James, you throw a 10-yard pass to John. And John would start running there, do an out route. And I would say, nope, time out. You can't do that. I said you had to stand toe-to-toe. You're moving. And they would look at me and say, well, you don't understand. To carry out that command, I have to have time. I have to have space. I have to have a field on which to play. I said, okay, you're right. Let's try this again. I'll give you a soccer ball. This time, I want you to make a goal around the corner over there, but stand toe-to-toe. And they would look at me and they say, well, we can't do that. We need a field on which to play. We need a soccer field. We need time. We need space, right? So that begins to make sense. And we could go down the list. We could look at basketball. We could look at golf. Golf requires what? A green. Basketball requires a field that we call a court, right? But it takes time. It takes space to play out. We could talk about tennis, ping pong, pickleball. All of those things require a field in which to play. Then we think about swimming. You say, ha, swimming does not use a field. We call it a pool. It is a medium. It is water. You have to have the water in which to swim, right? So everything that you think about requires a field on which to play in the general sense. And as we move from the, and I hope that makes sense, but as we move from the concrete to the more abstract, you think about, how do you hear me? Do you hear what I'm saying, right? So my vocal cords are creating vibrations in the air that travel to your ears. They bang on your eardrums and you hear, right? So sound, hearing, requires a medium. It requires the air. Our sound propagates through the air. Sound can go through water. It can go through steel. It can go through wood. But it requires a medium in which to operate. So the upshot is, you think about it, pretty much everything you see in life, from football to soccer to sound, requires a field on which to play or in which to operate. Okay, now back to light. What is required for the existence and the propagation of light? Did you know this puzzled physicist for centuries? And you may not think that that's a very hard problem, because we see each other right here, right? Light can propagate, can travel through air. You can see the bottom of your pool, it can travel through water. You can see through a window, it can travel through glass. But here's the question. When you walk outside and you look up and see the sun, how do you do that? How does that happen? If everything in our experience requires a field on which to play or a medium in which to operate, how do you see the sun? If space is this vast, empty void, there is no medium. There is nothing through which it can travel. This puzzled scientists for centuries. And it wasn't until, Christian Huygens, 1690, 17th century Dutch physicist, proposed a solution to the problem. So this is in late 17th century, that space must be filled with this vast, invisible, thin medium that he called the luminiferous ether. It means light bearing. And with this luminiferous ether, that's a fun word to say three times, that light could propagate through that medium. And that's how we see the sun. Problem solved. Well, that idea reigned for a couple of centuries. It wasn't finally put to bed until like 1920, right? But that was the solution. This is how it happens. We now understand light. Well, it turns out that's not true. You may have heard of the famous 1887 Michelson-Morley experiment, which began to say that's not true. And then it was finally put to bed in 1920. But that brings us back to square one. How do you go outside and you look up in the sky and you see the sun? How do you do that? Well, enter James Clerk Maxwell, 19th century Scottish physicist, who had a little bit to say about this deal. And he's considered basically one of the three greatest physicists of all time. If I were to ask for a show of hands, who are the greatest physicists? Everybody's going to say Einstein, Newton, and Maxwell. That's the top three that most people will say. Now, concerning Einstein, Einstein reflected on Maxwell, and he wrote this about Maxwell. Maxwell's work is the most profound and most fruitful that physics has experienced since the time of Newton. That's pretty high praise from Einstein. Now, what you're probably not going to learn in physics class is that Maxwell was a very devout Christian. I use that in the general sense. Did you know? By age 8, he could quote all 176 verses of Psalm 119. How many can do that? Right? Age 8. He grew up to be an apologist, an early apologist. He debated for the existence of God in scholarly forums and was even an elder in the Church of Scotland. Okay, but that aside, you're not going to learn that in physics class. Maxwell is most famous for ushering in a new era of physics by uniting the fields of electricity, magnetism, and optics, revolutionizing our understanding of light. So really, we have Maxwell to thank for how we understand light. Okay, so now, that being said, Maxwell described light through four very interesting equations. And they're recognized, you probably don't know this, you may not have heard this before, these differential equations are recognized to be among the most important and the most beautiful and elegant equations in physics. Because they're so beautiful and elegant, I do not want you to miss out on a chance to observe this beauty. All right, so here we go. Here are Maxwell's famous equations. I just need a moment, right, to appreciate the beauty. Now, I know, so we're going to talk about what they mean. I know that I don't need to tell you what equation one means, because everybody that knows, so E means electric field, B means magnetic field. So everybody knows that equation one means that electric fields have sources and sinks. They have plus and minus charges, right? You look at your battery, you have plus and minus, right? We get that. And I know everybody also knows that equation two, the divergence of a magnetic field equals zero. That means, and you're going to tell me what it means, when you pick up a bar magnet and you look at it, what does it have on either end? A north and a south. That's what that means. There are no monopole magnets. Magnets always have a north and a south. If you take that north-south magnet and you chop it in half, what happens to the north end? It becomes north and south. What happens to the south end? It becomes south and north, and you chop that in half, what happens? And you chop that in half, what happens? That's what that says, right? Now, since you told me what the first two easy ones say, I'm going to tell you what the next two say. And this is interesting for our purposes today. That little D, that means change. So what that says is a changing magnetic field induces or produces an electric field. Not too hard to understand. The last equation says just the opposite, a little more going on, but basically the changing electric field produces a magnetic field. Easy peasy lemon squeezy, right? 3D differential calculus is not hard. We know that. Changing magnetic field produces electric, changing electric produces magnetic. Okay, so we got this. All right, so what happens when you put all these together? What happens when they're all true at the same time? This is where Maxwell's genius was, okay? Let me show you what this is sort of an algebraic way to view it. Let me show you a geometric way to prove it, to look at it. It looks something like this. So what you have is the red is an electric field, and it's moving. It's inherently dynamic. It's going this way. And as it's going this way, the magnetic field is coming in and out. And they're perfectly synchronized. And they begin to shift energy back and forth between themselves. So then, where we get back to our discussion on fields, right? Everything we know from football to soccer to sound requires a field on which to play. This is a little more complex. We're playing two games at one time. We have two fields, right? So if for our magnetic component to exist, what kind of field does it need to play in? It needs a magnetic field to play in. The electric component needs to play in an electric field, right? So we have two fields. So here's where the third and fourth equations come into play. If we have a changing magnetic field, it produces the electric field. But that electric field that just was produced and it's playing around over here, it's creating the magnetic field. So then, one component produces the field in which the other component operates, and vice versa, in perfect synchronization as governed by specific rules. So the changing electric field creates the magnetic field, and the changing magnetic field creates the electric field. Now remember, we're going to eventually get around to faith. The light's probably beginning to come on now. Since you've been patient so far with this, I'm going to show you what this looks like dynamically, because the essence of this is inherently dynamic. It is inherently energetic. If the motion stops, the whole thing collapses. So I'm going to show you this when it's moving, but don't get too distracted with the pretty pictures, because I'm going to read you what Maxwell was thinking about as he's putting this together, and it's actually quite profound, okay? Now, I pulled this quote from the Northwestern University physics page describing Maxwell's thoughts on the ideas. Okay, so here we go. This is, again, you've got the electric field going up and down this way as the magnetic field is going this way, and then the whole thing is going in the orthogonal direction backwards, right? Okay, so as Maxwell is reasoning about this in his mind, here's what he says. If one could, in some way, produce a disembodied magnetic field in space and set it to oscillating, set it to moving, then it would produce an electric field. Then the oscillating electric field would produce a magnetic field, and so on in an endless cycle. Maxwell was able to show that if such a thing were to be created, the electric and magnetic fields would oscillate at right angles to each other, one going up and down, the other going in and out, and listen, would travel together while shifting energy back and forth between themselves as they constantly and dynamically regenerate each other. In other words, you would have an electric and magnetic fields existing by themselves with no charges, with no magnets, with no masses. In other words, light is a self-propagating, self-existent phenomenon. It needs no pre-existing medium in which to operate because it, in essence, produces its own medium. No need for a luminiferous ether. That's how you can go out and see the sun. Okay, so in summary, according to Maxwell, light is electromagnetic energy. You've got an electric component and a magnetic component. So light is composed of two independent components, an electric field and a magnetic field. Electricity is not magnetism. Magnetism is not electricity. Light is not simply electricity plus magnetism. It's not that simple. There's some rules involved. Instead, light is a phenomenon in which the electric and magnetic fields interoperate according to a precise set of rules, each generating or producing what the other one needs, constantly shifting energy back and forth between themselves in a self-propagating regenerative cycle in perfect synchronized fashion. Very profound. Very interesting. Now, we're ready to talk about light and the nature of God. What does God need to exist? What does God need to operate? What does God need to propagate His influence throughout the created order? Nothing. What does light need to exist? What does light need to propagate? What does light need to exist, operate, or propagate its influence throughout the created order? Nothing. God is light. Amazing. Okay, since you've been patient with me this far, and you're still awake, I'm actually surprised it's 8:30 in the morning and you're awake. We're gonna have a little fun, okay? So I tried to think about, okay, let's not get too bogged down in the equations. Let's see if we can conceptualize this in a little different way. So I have a little video for you to watch. And as we're doing this video, think about things like two independent elements, interoperation, synchronicity, synchronization, and self-propagation, okay? So you need to think about these things as you watch this video. And don't get too distracted again with the pretty pictures because I'm going to have some commentary on it. Okay, so what is this? This is a little video from Wallace and Gromit. You can go and Google, and there's hours and hours of this video. But this is a stop-motion animated comedy called Wallace and Gromit. And in this case, I pulled this little clip. Gromit has a problem, and he needs to solve this problem, and he needs to think about light. He needs to think about faith, right, while he's solving this problem. So his problem is he is riding on a train. Now, what kind of field does a train need to operate? What's its field? It's the track. But there's a problem because he's going to run out of track. Think Back to the Future, Marty McFly, right? 1.21 gigawatts. We're going to run out of that train track. Okay, so he's got to find a solution. Well, as he's going, he sees some spare track. So what can he do with that track? Okay, and think about interoperation, synchronization, and self-propagation. So, ready? I know you're ready. Here we go. Okay, so what we see here is the train needs the track on which to move, but the new track needs the train by which to move, and it all has to be synchronized by Gromit, placing the track in the right place at the right time. You see that? Right? So you have two things that need each other. The train needs the track, and the spare track needs the train. But it can't just happen by itself. There has to be an overriding synchronization. Now, this would be a better example if Gromit's on the front of the train, putting the new track out, and Wallace were on the back of the train picking up the old track and putting it back in the box. Then we would have conservation of track, right? That would be more like what we're talking about. I'm glad you got that. Very good. I'm surprised I threw that in. Okay, so again, the train needs the track on which to move, but the new track needs the train by which to move, right? And all has to be synchronized. Okay. So as not to be too distracting. Okay, now we're ready for light and the nature of faith. Okay, so again, talking about fields, what does faith need to exist? What does faith need to operate? What is the field of faith, if you will? Okay, so with these kind of things in mind, let's go back and look at some very familiar passages on faith and kind of view them through this lens. Okay, so one of the first passages we might think about is Romans 10:17. Faith comes by hearing. The implication is one believes that which one heard. So at least one component seems to be belief. Now, another very familiar passage that we often think about in terms of faith is Hebrews 11. There we read, by faith Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice. By faith Noah prepared an ark, right? By faith Abraham offered Isaac. But notice the emphasis on a subsequent consequence of that which was believed, or the necessary completion of a cycle. The implication is faith is not instantaneous or even discrete, but rather a cycle that plays out over time. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It plays out over time, but on what field does it play? All right, so thinking with this concept of fields and summarizing, remember back to our, get another picture up here, our discussion of light. We've got two fields going, each need each other. One component produces the field in which the other component operates, and vice versa, in perfect synchronization, governed by specific rules. Now I just relabeled it. We still have E and B, but I relabeled these as effort and belief, kind of moving ourselves toward faith. So is with this model, let's continue reading some passages on faith and see if we can get a little deeper insight. Hebrews 11:7 says, by faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. So what are the kind of the key elements there? First, we have he was divinely warned, right? That's the message from God. That's faith comes by hearing. Next, he was moved with godly fear. He believed the message that he heard intensely. The intensity rising to the level that he was moved. At that point, subsequent to that time, he acted. He prepared the ark. You see that there? All in those verses. And the culmination of all that is said to be faith, through which he was made righteous. Now, question one, what laid the groundwork for the action? What was the medium in which the action took place? What was necessary for it? Belief, right? Okay, now you're ready for question two. That was easy enough. This is more a rhetorical statement in a series of questions. Question two, Noah believed in God before the flood, right? Otherwise, he wouldn't have built the ark. Should be obvious. So Noah believed in God before the flood. Now, question subpoint one, was Noah's belief in God greater before or after the rain began to fall? You see that? Was Joshua's belief in God greater before or after the walls of Jericho fell? Was Moses' belief in God greater before or after the parting of the Red Sea? So now we're ready for question three, right? The conclusion. What lays the groundwork for sustained greater belief? What is the medium in which belief is sustained, extended, increased, and propagated? Is it not the contemplation of the consequence of the completed action? You see that? In all of those cases, it's the contemplation of the consequence of the completed action. So, in summary then, belief is the field on which actions play out, while actions are the field or the crucible in which greater belief is forged, each element requiring the other. And we've come full circle to light, to the self-existent nature of light, a self-proclaimed propagating entity, but instead of electricity and magnetism, we're talking effort and belief. Okay. So, kind of trying to summarize here, we're pulling all of this together and viewing it through this lens. What can we say? Faith is composed of two independent components, belief and works. Faith is not belief only. Faith is not works only. Faith is not simply belief plus works. That brings us full circle to Cain and Abel. Cain believed God. He heard God and he acted. He offered a sacrifice, right? But he did not have faith. There's more to it. There's some rules involved, right? And so we can state it this way. Faith is a phenomenon in which belief and works interoperate according to a precise set of rules, each generating what the other needs, constantly shifting energy back and forth between themselves in a self-propagating regenerative cycle in perfectly synchronized fashion. Example. Since I'm running out of time, this example is from Luke chapter 5. Verses 1 through 11, I'll just start reading in verse 4. This is where Jesus is calling his disciples. Verse 4 says, "When he had stopped speaking, he said to Simon, 'Launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch.' But Simon answered and said to him, 'Master, we have toiled all night and caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I will let down the net.' And when they had done this, they caught a great number of fish, and their net was breaking. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. When Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, 'Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord.' For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, 'Do not be afraid. From now on you will catch men.' So when they had brought their boats to the land, they forsook all and followed him." Okay, so now, with that said, let me ask you a series of questions. Question one, did Peter believe Jesus before casting the net? One more time. Did he believe Jesus before casting the net? Well, we know he did because he said, "I'll do it at your word," right? So we have initial belief. Now, question two, did Peter act on that belief? Yes, he did. He cast the net. Here's where it gets interesting. Question three, was the intensity of belief lesser or greater after Peter completed the request, casting the net, and then reflected on the implications of the result? Right? So we have verse four, Jesus says, "Cast the net." Peter says, "Okay, I guess maybe I will one more time." The action, he casts the net. There's a great catch. Then he thinks about it. He contemplates about it, and what happens? Does that induce greater belief? What does verse 8 say? Peter says, "I'm a sinful man." He has a new and a greater belief based on contemplating the consequence of the completed action. Did you see that? But then that new belief creates new action. What's that new action? Falling down and worshiping Jesus at his knees. Verse 8. After he thinks about that, what does he conclude? He concludes, "You must be the Lord." Did that conclusion lead to a new and a greater belief still? Yes, it did. What was that? Prepared his heart to hear the instruction that Jesus came next. "Follow me." New and greater belief. Did Peter believe that? And did he act on that? Did he forsake everything that he had, all that he knew, to follow Jesus? Do you see what's happening here? Do you remember back to the discussion of light? Do you see the cascading cycles of faith happening and building on each other? Each element, the belief and the action, they need each other. They shift energy back and forth. They create cycles that lead to greater and greater and greater faith. It's right there in front of us, but looking at it this way helps us see it a little better. So we're back to this faith cycle. Two independent elements interoperating in synchronized fashion, a cyclic faction, each producing what the other needs for existence, self-sustainment, and replication. Belief creates the fields on which action plays out. Action creates the field in which belief is amplified. Faith creates its own field in which to propagate similar delight, and thus is intended to be a perpetual force in your life, which anticipates Romans 1:17, from faith to faith. In the remaining time, let's look at that quickly. Remember Romans 1:16? For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now, volumes have been written on this idea of from faith to faith, but I think a plausible explanation would be this. The gospel is a system of faith received by faith and designed to perpetuate faith throughout the life of a Christian. In other words, faith is designed by God to be a self-perpetuating, self-sustaining force in your life in which belief and action interoperate in a very special way to draw you closer to Him. Since time is running out, let me just summarize some implications. Here we go. The great faith debate has always and will always be with us. We can understand biblical faith, though many, if most, will not. Number two, faith is not binary, but rather graduated. It starts small and it grows. Great expectations. Number three, God expects your faith to grow. Number four, faith is inherently active. It is inherently energetic. Faith cannot grow in a static environment. Number five, instances of faith are inherently cyclic. They have a beginning, they have a middle, they have an end. They play out over time, and that sheds light back to the beginning on the discussion between Paul versus James. Paul is talking about the first part of this cycle, the beginning of the cycle, the belief. James is talking about the end of the cycle, the completion of the cycle. In fact, that's the very word he uses. Abraham's faith was completed. It was finished by his actions. No contradiction whatsoever. And then finally, faith is a self-propagating, self-perpetuating by design. The gospel is a system of faith received by faith and designed to perpetuate faith throughout the life of a Christian. Whew. Thank you. I made it. And no one fell asleep.